Imagine like fighting a hurricane for years. You've just been treading water in this dark, violent sea.
Yeah, just constantly battling the current.
Right. It's spending literally every ounce of your life force just to keep from being pulled under. And then, miraculously, you wash up on a quiet, sunlit beach. You're safe.
Finally.
You would think the very first thing you'd do is celebrate, or, maybe just collapse in relief.
Absolutely, that would be the natural reaction.
But what if I told you the actual first requirement for surviving on this new shore is to completely destroy the very boat that just saved your
I
life?
mean, it sounds absurd. It sounds almost ungrateful, honestly.
It really does.
Because when we're caught in the turbulence of what we might call the dangerous shore, that suffocating realm of compulsion, reactivity, shame, all of that despair, survival is our entire
Yeah,
universe.
your whole focus narrows down to just that.
Exactly. The tools we use to escape, they become sacred to us. So asking someone to discard those tools the very moment they reach safety, well, it feels like asking them to walk right back into the ocean.
Which is exactly the paradox we're unpacking today. So, welcome to you, the listener, to this deep dive. Our mission today is to dig into Chapter 66, which is the conclusion of the Raft to Freedom program.
It's such a crucial chapter.
It really is. We are focusing on this final and honestly incredibly counterintuitive step of moving from merely surviving the dangerous shore to actually thriving on the safe shore.
Right. And as you'll see, that transition requires this sort of psychological teardown that is, quite frankly, often more terrifying than the crossing itself.
Oh, completely. But to understand the sheer scale of that terror, I think we first need to quickly look at the architecture of the vessel you used to cross that water in the first place.
Yeah, that context is essential. So the RAFT program uses the acronym RAFT, spelled RAFT, and pronounced just simply as the word RAFT. And this acronym maps out the four distinct movements of the journey. We're talking about recognize, abandon, feel, and drain.
Okay, so rather than just giving like boring textbook definitions, think about how these operate as a unified system. Like, recognize isn't just about casually noticing you have a problem. It's more like debugging code,
That's a great way to put it.
Because you can't fix a catastrophic glitch in your software until you isolate the exact line of code causing the error. And you have to do it without judging the code for being broken.
Yes, exactly. It's about mapping your own reactivity. You recognize that biological pull of compulsion, and you do it without bringing in that heavy, heavy blanket of shame.
Because the shame just drags you under.
It really does. And, well, that lack of shame is the prerequisite for the second movement, which is abandon.
And I feel like abandon gets misunderstood a lot.
Oh, constantly. Often, when people hear about abandoning behaviors or practicing restraint, they immediately interpret it as deprivation.
Like a really strict diet or something.
Right. They think of this clenched jaw asceticism where you're just denying yourself everything. But in the context of the RAFT program, abandoning is purely functional.
Functional how? Exactly.
Well, it's the profound relief of bailing out the water that is actively sinking you. You are letting go of this heavy cargo of craving and ill will simply because it threatens the buoyancy of your vessel.
Okay, that makes so much sense. You're just tossing the heavy stuff overboard so you don't sink.
Precisely.
And once you stop taking on water, you hit feel, which honestly I think might be the hardest part for a completely dysregulated nervous
Oh,
system.
without a doubt. It's terrifying for some.
Because feeling safety isn't just a void where the panic used to be, right? It has to be this active, living presence of calm.
Yes, deep calm and even like an energizing joy.
But when you've spent your whole life on the dangerous shore, quiet feels like a trick.
It feels like a trap.
It feels like the eye of the hurricane. You're just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Which is why you have to deliberately train your brain to actually savor that safety. And that leads right into the final movement. Train, meaning operating the middle way program.
The middle way. So staying out of the extremes.
Exactly. You aren't suppressing every single human urge with rigid punishing discipline. But at the same time, you also aren't just surrendering to every reactive impulse that pops up. You're developing skills, mindfulness, ethical conduct, so that the vessel actually becomes seaworthy in real, unpredictable weather.
It's kind of like the difference between memorizing a sailing manual and actually knowing how to sail.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Because at first, you're white-knuckling the tiller, you're checking the rigging every 10 seconds, absolutely terrified of a rogue wave.
You're relying completely on external instructions.
Right. But over time, the crew learns to work as one.
Yeah.
The mechanics of the RAFT just become second nature. You feel the tension in the lines. You just, I don't know, you just know how to read the wind.
And that transition right there from external rigid rules to embodied fluid skill, that is the true marker that you are nearing the safe shore.
Yeah.
The structure of the RAFT program has done its job. The keel scrapes the sand. You step out of the water.
You've made it.
You've made it. And this brings us to this really foundational story from Gautama the Buddha that the text relies on heavily. It's known as the simile of the raft.
Oh, I love this one. Let me set the scene for this because the visual is just so brilliant.
Go for it.
So Gautama describes this man who is desperate to escape a terrifying shore. He gathers branches, binds them all together, and using his hands and feet, he paddles with this immense, grueling effort across a raging river.
Just fighting for his life.
Exactly. Until he finally reaches safe ground, he is completely victorious. But then, standing there on the beach, he looks at his makeshift boat and he thinks, "This raft saved my life. I owe it everything. I should hoist it onto my head and carry it with me wherever I go from now on."
And then Gautama poses a question to his listeners, which is that man doing what should be done with the raft?
I mean, it's a ridiculous image.
It really is.
Just picture a guy trekking through a dry, beautiful forest, like hundreds of miles from the nearest drop of water, just sweating under the weight of a heavy wooden boat balanced on his skull.
Right. The logic is simple, but it's ruthless. The raft is for crossing over, not for clinging to.
Yeah.
Once it has served its purpose, the wise action is to haul it onto dry land or just let it drift away and then walk freely. But let's ground this metaphor for a second.
Okay, let's do that.
For the listener who has been utilizing the raft program, what is the wood they are balancing on their heads?
Oh, man. Well, it's the framework of the program itself, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the structured routines, the specialized vocabulary, that constant hypervigilance.
All the mechanics of survival.
Right. But I think it goes deeper than that. And this is where I think it gets really painful for people. The raft is actually the identity you build while you're surviving.
Absolutely. The identity of being the struggler.
Or the broken one. Or, you know, the person who is perpetually working on their issues.
Yes. We cling to that identity of the broken one healing. Because, honestly, it provides a map in a chaotic world. It gives us a full-time job.
It does.
And giving up that job feels dangerously irresponsible.
Okay, but I have to challenge this expectation of dropping the identity, though. Let's look at it from the perspective of someone who has spent, say, a decade fighting severe compulsion.
Fair enough. Let's look at that.
That identity of being a survivor or this vigilant warrior against their own reactivity, that was their armor.
It was everything to them.
Exactly. That identity is what kept them from slipping back into the dark water. So if you tell them to just leave the raft on the beach and walk into the forest naked, so to speak, aren't you making them incredibly vulnerable? Like, how do they know they won't just wander right back into the ocean?
That fear of wandering back into the water is so universally felt, and it's entirely valid. I want to be clear about that.
Right.
But it assumes that the safety actually resides in the physical wood of the raft, like in the rules, the labels, the constant state of alarm.
Oh, I see.
But remember the sailing analogy we just discussed. By the time you reach the safe shore, those skills of mindfulness, patience, and discernment, they are no longer external instructions written on a piece of paper.
They're built in.
Exactly. They are in your nervous system. They've become embodied capacities.
So the crew already knows how to sail. You don't need to carry the boat because the knowledge of how to float is quite literally in your bones.
Beautifully put, yes. You are shifting away from a self-defining statement like, "I am a fundamentally broken person trying not to drown," to a much more resilient, workable truth.
Which is?
I am someone who is learning to steer.
Wow. Learning to steer.
Right. You don't lose your ability to navigate just because you stop calling yourself a shipwreck victim. Dropping the raft just means you are no longer defined by what you had to escape.
That reframing from "I am broken" to "I am learning to steer" is incredibly liberating.
It really changes everything.
But, you know, it also leads to a massive misconception about what we are actually steering toward.
Oh, definitely. The destination itself gets misunderstood.
Because when I hear the term safe shore, my mind immediately conjures up like an island resort.
Pina coladas on the beach.
Exactly. Zero problems, no conflict, endless sunshine. I imagine this state of enlightened perfection where I just never feel a negative emotion ever again.
And sadly, chasing that mythical island is a fantastic way to end up right back in the water.
Right.
The text of the RAFT program is incredibly clear on this point. The safe shore is not a geographical destination where storms never arise.
Because life will still life.
Life will absolutely still life. You will still encounter loss, sickness, professional failure, interpersonal conflict,
right.
All of it.
The shadows of old habits might still surface too.
Exactly. The defining characteristic of the safe shore isn't the absence of storms. It is simply the fact that you no longer drown in them.
We have to dig into the actual mechanics of that, because if the storms are still happening and the old urges are still occasionally whispering in your ear, how are we not drowning?
It's a great question.
The text breaks this down beautifully, I think, showing how our internal processing shifts. So let's start with the biological reality. What is physically different in our brains once we establish footing on this shore?
Well, neurologically, we undergo a massive reorganization.
Okay.
On the dangerous shore, your nervous system is dictated primarily by the amygdala. It is organized entirely around threat detection and alarm.
Like the negativity bias on overdrive.
Exactly. It's where every minor inconvenience, like, I don't know, a sideways glance from your boss or a traffic jam, is interpreted by the brain as a life or death crisis.
And that requires an immediate, often compulsive reaction.
Yes. But through the repeated practice of the RAFT framework, you've been doing the agonizing work of pausing.
Right. You feel that spike of panic, but you just don't feed the reactive loop.
And because we know that neurons that fire together wire together.
Oh, right.
Every single time you pause and choose a different response, you are physically starving that old neural pathway.
So you're actually rewiring your brain.
You really are. You are moving from a state of chronic alarm to a state of integration and regulation.
Meaning the impulse might still fire, but the prefrontal cortex stays online.
Yes, the part of brain responsible for perspective and choice.
Yeah.
You can observe the biological urge without being totally hijacked by it.
Which feeds directly into the psychological shift, right?
Right.
We basically stop fighting the unavoidable pain of human existence.
Exactly. The psychology changes completely.
Because I know on the dangerous shore, if I felt sad or triggered, my immediate psychological response was always shame. I would think, I'm feeling bad, therefore I am failing, I am defective.
That's such a common trap.
And then I would use compulsion just to escape that shame. So how do we actually dismantle that shame on the safe shore? What's the mechanism there?
The mechanism is decoupling the event from your self-worth. It's this profound act of acceptance.
Okay, what does that look like in practice?
You learn to say, I am experiencing the biological sensation of anxiety right now. This is a difficult moment. Mm-hmm. And then full stop.
No adding to it.
Right. You do not add the second arrow, as Buddhist psychology calls it.
Oh, the first arrow versus the second arrow.
Yes. The first arrow is the unavoidable pain of life, the traffic jam, the illness, the loss.
Right.
But the second arrow is the story we tell ourselves about the pain. It's the shame, the self-hatred, the belief that we shouldn't be hurting in the first place.
So dropping the raft means basically refusing to shoot yourself with that second arrow.
Yes, and that brings us to the philosophical underpinning of this entire chapter. It draws really heavily on early Buddhist thought and also Stoicism.
Oh, I love the Stoic connection here. Both traditions emphasize the exact same crucial gap.
They do.
The gap between stimulus and response. The Stoics actually had a great word for this proheresis. It's our capacity for reasoned choice.
Yes, proheresis.
Because we don't control the external events. And honestly, we don't even control the initial thoughts or feelings that just pop into our heads.
We really don't. The brain just produces them.
Right. But we do control our assent to them. Like if an old reactive urge knocks on the door, we don't have to sign the receipt for the package. We can just let it sit on the porch.
That is the perfect analogy. Just leave it on the porch. That is the very essence of living skillfully on the safe shore.
It's so freeing.
It is. Because freedom is not moral perfection. Mm-hmm. It is not about eradicating every impure thought or, you know, never having a bad day. Freedom is responsiveness.
Responsiveness over reactivity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is the ability to check the hull of your life, recalibrate your compass when you inevitably drift, and then just begin again.
Without turning a momentary stumble into a final verdict on your character.
Yes, exactly that.
It's kind of like knowing you have an anger. Like the surface of the ocean might be completely wild. You might get tossed around. You might get seasick.
You will definitely get seasick sometimes.
Right. But there is this fundamental bedrock knowing that you are not going to be swept out to the open sea. The safe shore isn't a place on a map. It's that internal embodied way of being.
And recognizing that the shore is a way of being leads us to the final and perhaps most vital challenge of chapter 66. Well, if the safe shore is an internal state, how do we actually sustain it against the constant wear and tear of daily life. How do we keep that anchor secure?
Oh, I see where you're going with this. We don't do it alone.
No, we don't.
The whole idea of the solitary, stoic hero just surviving entirely on their own grit, it's a total myth.
It really is. Community, or what is traditionally referred to as Sangha, is the true bedrock of the safe shore.
You just can't walk this terrain in isolation for long without losing your bearings.
You really can't.
There is this brilliant exchange in the texts between Gautama and his closest attendant, Ananda, that perfectly captures this, I think.
Yes, I know exactly the one you mean.
So Ananda approaches Gautama one day, right? And he's clearly been thinking deeply about the nature of their practice. And he says, you know, I think good friendship, good companionship is half of the spiritual life.
And he thinks he's offering this really profound insight.
Totally. He's expecting a pat on the back.
And Gautama stops him immediately. He corrects him right there, saying, not so, Ananda. Good friendship is the whole of the spiritual life.
The whole of it, not just a supplement, not some nice-to-have support network for when things get a little tough. It is the entire point of the endeavor.
We have to look at the mechanics of why that is true, though.
Okay, let's break that down.
Because on the dangerous shore, safety is a very scarce resource. You are acting out of pure survival instinct, which is inherently, well, self-focused.
Right, you're hoarding every bit of energy just to keep your own head above water. You can't worry about anyone else.
Exactly. But once you establish your footing on the safe shore, the dynamic completely flips. Having stabilized your own nervous system, you actually become capable of co-regulation.
Oh, wow.
You become stable ground for others.
That is honestly the most beautiful redemptive paradox of this entire journey.
Isn't it?
You spend all this time, all this frantic, desperate energy building a raft just to save your own life. You do all this grueling internal work purely trying not to drown.
Just trying to survive.
Right. But the ultimate reward of all that, you know, selfish survival work is that you inadvertently become a lighthouse for someone else.
Yes. Personal relief matures into generosity.
Yeah.
Because when one raft successfully reaches the shore, it proves to everyone else that the shore actually exists.
Your presence becomes a landmark for everyone still out there navigating those turbulent waters.
Exactly. And your lived understanding of the flood, it gives you this quiet, steady authority. You don't have to preach or hand out manuals to people.
Right. Often it just means embodying calm in a room where someone else is completely overwhelmed.
Just being a grounded presence.
It means listening without that immediate urge to fix them or judge them. Mm. You literally just offer the solid ground of your own regulated nervous system for them to temporarily stand on.
And when one person steadies, the waters around them steady too. That is the ultimate conclusion of the raft program.
It's so powerful.
The safe shore expands through connection. You drop that heavy identity of the solitary survivor, and you step into the role of a participant in a much larger ecosystem of healing.
Wow. Well, as we bring this deep dive to a close, we really want to make sure you have the map to continue this exploration on your own terms.
Absolutely.
The framework, the philosophy, and all the practical tools we've been dissecting today, they are drawn from the RAFT to Freedom workbook, which is authored by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And what is truly remarkable and honestly perfectly in line with that whole concept of generosity we just discussed is that the authors are making the entire 66-chapter workbook freely available online.
Which is just incredible. So you can access all of this material at raft2freedom.org. The work is licensed under Creative Commons, meaning it is specifically designed to be shared, used, and passed along to anyone who is still looking for the shore.
So again, you can find everything we talked about today at raft2freedom.org.
Before we sign off, we want to leave you with a direct question to reflect on in the quiet moments of your day. Just a way to check your own internal coordinates.
A really important question.
Ask yourself this. Am I ready, even tentatively, to loosen the identity of the one who is surviving and begin to inhabit the identity of one who is thriving?
In the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer. Albert Camus.
Suppose I were to haul the raft onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Gautama.